Would you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. It is a custom at this meeting to read a portion of Chapter 5 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, Fred has been asked to read this for us.
Hi, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find a softer, easier way, but we could not. With all the earnestness in our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will, our lives, over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personally inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to principal these in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. And the point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear these pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Herbal adherence. Never took that. The 12 traditions are to the group what the 12 steps are to the individual today. Linda has been asked to read this for us.
Good evening, I'm Linda. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Okay, the format of today's meeting is the leader qualifies for 5 minutes, followed by the main speaker. I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May 10th of 1988. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my first drink when I was 13 on my own. I had plenty of drinks before that from family members. And had my first drink when I was 13, had my last one hopefully when I was 29. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I was pissing and moaning and crying, and I thought my name was Does Anybody Want to Share at every meeting I went to. And I had lots of problems. UC people seemed to have the answers, and you know, I wasn't getting my way. You told me I had to change one thing, and that was everything. And I was really thrilled to meet you guys. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I did absolutely nothing. And I got a sponsor. My sponsor saved my life. My first sponsor saved my life, and he quit answering his phone when he was 90 days. When I was 30 days sober, my son had open heart surgery. I signed divorce papers earlier that day and drove to UCLA and had my 15-month-old son cut from his neck to his belly button, and he had open heart surgery. The modern medicine had cured my son, and he's a very healthy young boy, but the story that I would like to tell is that the guy that saved my life, who was on the other end of the phone, remember what his primary purpose was. I was too new to want to go to AA meetings down in California. So I called this guy every day, and he'd answer his phone, and he'd walk me through it. And you know, I was just a wreck. Like, I'm sure you guys weren't wrecks when you were 30 days sober, but I was. And he walked me through everything. To make a long story short, a couple years later, he quit answering his phone when he was 90 days sober, and he'd been in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And the progression of this disease, you know, he could never get it. He'd always come in from the street, get cleaned up, get a new job, get new clothes, and then go back out and get drunk and loaded. And one day he had enough. And this is what keeps me keep coming back, because the guy's still saving my life, is that one day in front of his ex-wife, his ex-mother-in-law, and his son, he grabbed a knife and stuck it through his heart. So that's what alcoholism does to people like me. You know, Cliff talked about last night. I keep coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time, You know, I've worked the steps to the best of my ability. I stay in service, but, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, so I keep on showing up to Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't want to end up like my first sponsor. You know, my second sponsor helped me. My third sponsor has been sober 36 years, and he's an old-timer. Can't remember where to meet me. But he never forgets what step I'm on, you know what I mean? I was like, you know, and he'll come up to me and he'll put his arms around me and tell me, you know, when are we going to get together, you know? And I just melt. And I love that guy. And I love you people. And I really, really am grateful to be here. Man, if you're not having a good time here, you know, you can't screw this one up. This is a no-brainer. This is a beautiful place. I love it. Thanks, guys, Steve and Annette, for letting me share. And I'd like to introduce Sean, our main speaker.
You know, when you quit drinking, it's going to be all gray. I mean, there's not going to be any fun. You're going to spend the rest of your life in church basements filled with smoke with a lot of people you never even wanted to drink with. It's all going to be grim. There's, you know, and none of the problems are going to get solved. It's going to be a nightmare. Well, welcome to the nightmare. My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you for asking us to be here. This is really, really wonderful. We needed a vacation, and you guys, this is just terrific. I went snorkeling today, and my ears filled up with water, and they haven't unfilled, and so I feel like I'm talking to you from the bottom of the reef. It's just really an incredible feeling. And inside my head, I sound like Daffy Duck. I don't know what I sound like out there, but it's... Alcoholics Anonymous is a tribe, and if you study anthropology and you look at the structure of a tribe, we really kind of qualify as a classic tribe. Originally, tribes were formed by small groups of people who were protecting each other and themselves against a hostile wilderness, and when they gathered together to form these kind of familial groups, nobody in the tribe got to just kind of hang out. Everybody had a job and everybody was useful. And you can see that function in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, you've stepped into one. We make everybody useful here. There's the people who tend the fires, who make sure that the fire is always going so that there's a place for us to gather. And they're the ones that get to the meetings at 6:30 at night for the 8:30 meetings to make sure the coffee's on and that's happening. And they're the hunters, and they're the ones that bring the food in and make sure that there's nourishment there. And they're the ones who make the trip on the bus across town to buy the literature and bring it back and make sure that it's there at the AA meeting. Or the ones who stop off on the way home from work to buy the cookies for the thing and make sure that that's happening. And they're the nurturers and the gatherers, and those are the ones that are terrific at sponsorship. Those are the ones that the one-on-one, you know, the unspectacular ones who bring the new ones in and out of the wilderness and tell them they're safe and make it okay for them. And they're the warriors, and the warriors are in the classic sense the ones who protect the tribe, and they're the ones that make sure that the traditions are alive, and they're the ones who are the intergroup reps and the general service reps who go out and do that. And the scouts go to other tribes in various parts of the world and come back and say it's okay if you're going to go there, they're like us. And there are the shamans, and the shamans are the ones who somehow have a magic about them that can translate this thing that we're doing into terms that we can understand. And occasionally you hear them from podiums. You're not going to hear it tonight, but you hear them from podiums. And they're the elders. The elders in Alcoholics Anonymous are the elders in classic tribal North American. Some of the northeastern tribes, when someone was elected chief, what he did was he gave away all his worldly possessions so that he was a servant of the tribe. And that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is we become trusted servants. And the elders in Alcoholics Anonymous are not merely old. What they do is they gather the only thing that is of value in Alcoholics Anonymous. They gather sober experience and they share it with us. And tonight I am in the company of elders. Some of the people that have gone before me and have affected my sobriety, I'm the product of the sobriety that you're hearing here throughout this week. People who have affected my life while they were talking to somebody else at the coffee urn, you know? It's really an honor. And then there are the storytellers, and the storytellers were an oral tradition here. We pass our stories back and forth between each other so that we can identify and stay here. And tonight, that's my function. And in this tribe, what we do is we ask you to form all of those functions, to serve in all those areas. And we do that. We wash cups, and we buy literature, and we go to the bathroom and get elected GSR, and we... And we think we're never going to have anything for anybody, and then some shaking jerk walks in and throws up on our shoes and then asks us to be a sponsor, you know. And we get to do all that stuff. And what happens out of it is that you and I, from all the tribes all over the place, get to gather in places like this to celebrate what we've mutually found. So we have a gathering of the tribes here tonight, and I'm really glad to be part of it. I want you to know that I'm standing here tonight because I love to drink. I mean, make no mistake about that. I just loved it. I not only love the effect, but I love the festival. You know, I love the ice cubes, and I love the things in the glasses. I love swizzle sticks, and I love coconuts with umbrellas. You know, I love dumb drinks. I love martini glasses. I love olives on toothpicks. You know, I love kind of smashing the bottle on the top of a beer bottle, you know, and doing it that way. I like any way I could get it. I just love the whole thing about it. I love the fact that I just love getting ripped. Just ripped, you know, just wrecked. I live with a non-alcoholic, and if you'd have heard her talk this afternoon, she didn't take a Sudafed today because it may make her drowsy. I mean, I think probably half a dozen of those in a bottle of gin would have been great, you know? Just wonderful. But I love the whole thing, and I love the effect of it. See, I was born in a normal alcoholic home. My father was a drunkard, my mother was a saint. And they did that dance. And one of the things that I noticed about Dad was when he drank, he changed. And I kind of stashed that information away for the time when us drunks hit our critical period. I mean, 13, 14 years old, you got to change. You know, something called puberty is happening. And puberty looked really upsetting to me, so I skipped it. I mean, it looked, you know, just kind of uncomfortable. Because when I was 14, I was extremely uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable with who I was, where I lived, what I looked like. I was born in this jerky town in Canada, Victoria, you know, and God, all I wanted out of that town was out. And I had these relatives that were just bizarre, and I was tall and fat, and thick glasses and crooked teeth, and I was weird, and I was just uncomfortable. And when I was 14 years old, I found comfort. Southern comfort is what I found, and I love that stuff. I just love that stuff. It just, you know, it was like taking a bite out of a thunderstorm. You know, the lightning crackled all the way down, and there was this deep roll of thunder at the bottom. You know, and I understood at that moment, at a gut level, why my father was willing to go to jail so much. You know, it just felt felt fabulous coming up too. You know, it just, the whole thing about it was just wonderful. And I kind of came to several hours later, under a bush, heaving my guts out. You know. And I could hardly wait to do it again. It just was, because what happened is that first time that I drank, until the last time that I drank, I had that moment, you know? And it always changed. I could never pinpoint when it was going to happen. It may have been after two drinks or four drinks in a joint, or, you know, three drinks and a couple of prescription drugs. And so, you know, I never knew what the combination was, but all of a sudden there was that. You know that, you know that moment. You know when everything was perfect, when I was tough but tender, you know? Sexy but sensitive, a great dancer but fast with my fists, and a poet but streetwise. an intellectual with a common touch. You know, just, oh man, it was fabulous, you know. And then what would happen is it would start to kind of slip a little, so I'd have another belt just to kind of sustain it. And I was a blackout drinker. You know, in Star Trek, when they hit warp speed, it just kind of goes whoosh, you know. Well, that would happen to me. It would just be whoosh, and it'd be an hour and a half later, and there'd be 15 people standing around going, and I knew I'd done it again. You know, I just, something god awful had happened, and I was somehow involved. But the thing was, is that moment was so magical that over the years I became willing to pay a higher and higher price for it. And that's addiction. That's alcoholism. Eventually, what happened is the price killed me. I hear people saying that alcohol stopped working for them. And if that had ever happened to me, I'd have stopped drinking. I'm not stupid, but it never did. There was always that thing. It happened from the first time I drank until the last time I drank. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you said you were going to take that away from me, that I would never ever experience that again, I was angry. And I was terrified because I was going to live this kind of gray life, you know, where we were going to be good and we were going to kind of be nice to each other and everybody was going to get to take advantage of us. And I thought, oh my God. But by that time, I was so desperate that I was willing to do it. I mean, by that time, by the time I arrived here, if you'd have told me I have to stand stark naked on Hollywood Boulevard and light my hair on fire in order to stay sober, I'd have done it because I was that desperate. Now, I am 14 years old, getting drunk. By the time I was 20 years old, I was a daily blackout drinker, and I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, so I went to New York to become an actor. And I saw the skyline of Manhattan, and I said, in 5 years, you're going to know my name. And in 5 years, a lot of people did know my name for a lot of the wrong reasons, but a lot of them knew my name. And I got to do a lot of interesting things. I got to do a lot of Broadway shows, and I got to go to a lot of wild parties, and the 60s hit. You know, oh, man. And it was wonderful. And what happened in the 60s was I became part of that group that messed up this disease. You know, some of the old timers kind of think that we're the kind of guys that kind of ruined a perfectly respectable disease. I am an impure alcoholic. I just want you to know that I've ingested a lot of outside issues. And I'm just wondering if some of the old-timers had had the opportunity and the access to them, if they wouldn't have tried them too, but I don't know, you know. But I sure did as many of them as I could, as often as I could, and it was just fabulous. It was just, you know, I was just kind of mellow or wild or just all, you know, whatever I felt like being. I'd just take something for it, you know, and I just, woohoo! It was just, oh, God. By the time I was 24 years old, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I picked up a little non-habit-forming marijuana habit, and I was working the docks. Now, not the kind where the ships come in, but the kind, you know, the guys who write the prescriptions. I just love doctors. I mean, as a class, they're probably the stupidest people I've ever met in my life. One of the things that I learned real quickly is doctors don't know how to say goodbye. And if you're an alcoholic, you learn that really fast. You know, they don't say, goodbye, get out of my office. What they do is they write things. You know, I guess they must learn that in medical school. That's how you enter an interview. So what I did was I got a medical book and memorized symptoms for the kind of drugs I wanted. And I would go and tell them that I was suffering from whatever it was. And they'd say, oh. And they'd write me something. And then I'd go see the other two guys, you know. And then I'd get them all filled, and then we'd meet for drinks and swap pills. It was fun. I'll give you a red one. How about a white one? Ooh, an orange one. Ooh, a yellow one. I haven't seen a yellow one. Ooh. I was the kind of drunk that if you invited me to your house for dinner, at some time during the evening, I would excuse myself, and I'd go to your bathroom and go through your medicine cabinet. And I'd take whatever was pretty. So 20 minutes later, you'd either find me sprawled on the bathroom floor in a coma, or you'd have to peel me off the bathroom ceiling, depending on what I found in your medicine cabinet. And I was in my mid-20s, and I was living the great lie of alcoholism, and the great lie of alcoholism is, you've still got time. You can do this for another week or two, Sean, then you got to straighten up, and then you'll be all right. And I didn't like to look at the fact that there were a lot of people around me who were my age and younger, who were real cute and adorable and like me, you know, who were dying from this disease, but it didn't look like it. Because we're the kind of drunks, you know, I was successful. I was adorable. You know, I was cute and talented and bright and all that stuff. And so it doesn't look like alcoholism in our case. What happens is We forget how much scotch we drank with how much Seconal. You know, we lose, we forget to turn off the gas. We pass out with cigarettes and set our sofas on fire. We fall out of windows. We trip in front of buses. We hit bridge pilings at 90 miles an hour, you know. There's kind of accidents that happen to guys like us. Or we get beaten to death in alleys because a lot of guys like me have smart mouths. One of my favorite things to do was to go into bars, you know, really kind of rough, tacky bars, and kind of check it out, you know, notice that there was this group that didn't seem to like this group, and that guy seemed to be the leader, and that guy seemed to be the leader of that, so I kind of work it around and maybe tell that leader had said something about him, and then watch each other kill each other. I thought it was really fun. The only problem is occasionally they talk to each other, and then they turn on me. And the fact that I'm here and alive is amazing. I used to get drunk on the east side of Manhattan, and at 3 o'clock in the morning decide I couldn't get a cab, and I lived on the west side, so I'd walk across Central Park in a suit. And I mean, you don't live through that. But, you know, and there I was. But I was in trouble. I was in desperate trouble, and I was starting to look into solutions for my life. I started the thing because Alcoholics Anonymous was the last door. I mean, I tried all the rest. I did everything I could to avoid coming here, let me tell you. And so I started that. I decided that I went to a shrink and I entertained him for 8 months. Now, he helped me. He really did. He got me down to a fifth of scotch a day, and he gave me a prescription for Valium and another one for Seconal. God bless that man. Now, I don't put down shrinks. I just think that shrinks are incapable of helping practicing alcoholics because we're incapable of telling the truth. It's just that simple. I told my psychiatrist what I told the last arresting officer. Two beers. That's, you know, anybody in authority asked me, it was two beers. Bonnie says that if somebody admits to three beers, they're not an alcoholic. He was really interested in various conditions that I had. And the problem with psychiatry in a drunk like me is what psychiatrists generally were trying to do is understand my feelings, and then they're going to change my behavior. Well, I mean, they couldn't get to it because I was lying. And Alcoholics Anonymous is perfect for me because what they say is we'll change your behavior first, and then we'll work on your feelings. And that's the kind of therapy that works great for me. I decided what I needed was a good woman, and so I found her in an elevator. We were going to rehearse a show together, and she was a dancer. She was the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. She was a little blonde with dimples, and she was really... Our eyes locked, you know, and that horrible, you know, that eye lock, that pre-Al-Anon alcoholic eye lock, and you know, when an Al-Anon recognizes potential. I mean, you're dead meat once it happens. I mean, it's over, you know. So I was terrified, so I started dating somebody else. But we became friends, and eventually we became more than friends, and eventually we got together, and our friends called us the Campbell Soup Kids. They said we were the cutest kids on the block. And we were in the theater, we had this little apartment, and we were going to parties. And see, now drunks don't marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink, so I certainly wasn't going to marry anybody who didn't drink. And she drank. Man, could she drink. She was great. So we partied. We had a lot of fun. And we did a national tour, which is an Actors Geographic. We came out to L.A., I decided things were going to be better in L.A. It was warmer. I don't know. We decided to stay there, and we got married, and she settled down. We were having our cocktails one night, she took a sip of hers and said, "This is boring," and she put it down the coffee table, and she didn't drink. She never drank again. She didn't go through withdrawals. Nothing. I mean, it just stopped. She's not an alcoholic. It was just weird. And then she noticed that I drank. And then the fun began. You know, the thing of, you know, let me drive, you've been drinking too much, you know, when we go to the party, would you kind of not drink so much? You know, that whole dance. And it was all real familiar because it was stuff from my parents and it was stuff from her parents. We both came from alcoholic homes, so we knew the dance. You know, we knew the alcoholic dance. We knew the... we knew all the choreography. We just know, you know in an alcoholic marriage, you know, you can, those fights where you can take it right to the point where you're going to say the thing that's going to blow it apart, and then you back off from it a little, you know, just so you both know what the phrase is. You know, we did all that kind of stuff. The only problem was that I was a blackout drinker, and occasionally I stepped over it, and we got into some real trouble. And I was trying real hard to be a good guy. I've always been trying to be a good guy. You know, I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what the rules. Everybody else seemed to know what the rules were, but I didn't. I mean, I missed the mimeograph sheet somewhere, and I was out there just trying to be okay, and I've never been okay that I can remember. So it went on. It just went on, and it was just nuts. And I made up a rule that I followed faithfully into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. The one rule was that I never drank before 5 o'clock in the afternoon, except on Sundays and holidays. And the other one was that I always drank from a glass. That was very important to me because my father was a drunk, and we used to find wine bottles wrapped in brown paper bags. And I knew if you did that, you were a drunk. So I poured it into. I poured my rot gut into glasses. It was very, you know. Just before I got sober, there was a Time magazine article about alcoholism, and what they said was, you know, they showed a chart, you know, and it talked about how many drinks you drink, you know. What they suggested was that kind of controlled drinking. I love that idea. I mean, I just think it's monstrous. I mean, if somebody suggested to me to control my drinking, I'd tell you the secrets to the neutron bomb. I mean, the idea of two drinks a night, my first response to that is, how big are the glasses? But it was just insane. It was terrifying, and it ceased to be a luxury for me. It was now a necessity. It was medication. It was keeping me from going crazy because there was something terribly, terribly wrong. And I was keeping it packaged as well as I could, man. We had a little house in the Hollywood Hills, and I drove what I call a classic Mercedes. It was an old Mercedes, was what it was. And I had enough kind of spiffy sports jackets so that you didn't know that if we had a blowout on the old Mercedes, we'd have had to declare bankruptcy. You know, I'm just right on the. We didn't eat, but I drove a Mercedes. You know, and it was just getting really desperate and crazy, and bam, it exploded. It just exploded, and on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested, dead drunk, taken down, fingerprinted, photographed, and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband to the knees soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. It got my attention because a nice guy who drinks a little too much doesn't find himself in this kind of circumstance. And I went home that night, and luckily Bonnie wasn't there. She was off saving somebody who didn't need to be saved. And I was alone. And thank God for that. I mean, God just works stuff out just great. Because if we'd have been there, we'd have formed that team, you know, and we'd have talked it through, and it would have been their fault. And I would have been a victim of some kind of thing. And my God, how could that happen to a nice guy like you? And why don't you have just a little drink just to kind of calm down? But she wasn't there, and what I had to do was I had to look at my behavior. And for the first time in my life, on April 23rd, 1974, at about 11 o'clock at night, I put together my behavior with my drinking. I suddenly saw that there was a connection between the trouble I was in and the way that I was acting with my drinking. And until that second, I wasn't an alcoholic. Because this is a self-diagnosed disease. It doesn't matter how many earnest people suggested that I drank too much. There weren't any interventions at that point, but I'm sure if a group had gathered to talk to me about my drinking, I would have thought that they were overreacting. Until I said I was an alcoholic, I wasn't an alcoholic. And I was a hopeless case until I was at that point. But I saw the connection. And I said, I wonder if I'm an alcoholic. That's the incredible thing about us drunks is our unbelievable ability to overlook overwhelming evidence. Now, what I did was I demanded a miracle from God. I mean, by this point, my wife was insane. My wife was highly overreactive. My wife had a hair trigger temper. And what had happened is this kind of feisty, blonde, funny, talented, enormously talented woman that I had married, that I had managed to trick into marrying me, was shriveling in front of my face. She had become small and mean. Her nails were bitten to the quick. She wouldn't buy any new clothes, so she wore kind of like, you know, schmatas, you know, those kind of, you know, kind of moo-moo kind of stuff. And she'd never get her hair done, so she had her hair wrapped in babushkas, and her lips were disappearing. You know that Al-Anon look? You know, nothing was funny. And she had a vicious mouth. And she was unhappy, and she was frightened all the time. The effects of my disease was killing the person that I loved the most. And I didn't know what to do about it, because I couldn't stop drinking. I knew that. I tried to moderate. I changed the formulas. I did all the stuff, but I never stopped because I knew I couldn't. I just wanted to make peace with this somehow. I just wanted to live with this thing that was eating my guts out inside. Just figure out a way to tame it, because I knew I'd never be rid of it. And that night, I said, okay, God, I want a miracle, man, and I want it now, and I want to vanish. I don't want to be here in the morning. I don't care how you work that out. I don't want to be here in the morning. I didn't want to kill myself, because I knew if she came home and found a dead body in our bedroom, she'd go over the edge, and that was the one thing I couldn't do to her. I came to the next morning, and I was here. And I was awfully upset. I was not a happy camper. What I didn't know is that God answers prayers. It's just that God does it in the weirdest way. Because I went to work that day, by God. I was a functioning alcoholic. You know, I had a wife who worked. I went in and I worked. That was important to me. I got dressed up. I was reeking of cheap vodka, and I went in. And I was in real estate at that point, and I had to drive to go look at all the new listings. And it was my turn to drive. So into my car jumped three women. One of them was a woman named Suzanne L. Suzanne at that point had 6 years of sobriety. She was great. Talk about a program of attraction. She was this great-looking blonde lady, and she had a great sense of humor, and I'd been watching her for a year. The other woman was Mary. Now, Mary was about 75 years old, and she was Irish, and she drank every day. She just had a little drink or two every day. And the other one was Chris, and Chris was going through a divorce, and she was drinking too much. So we're driving around looking at all these houses, and they're talking about drinking. They're talking about alcoholic drinking and situational drinking and whether you're drinking, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, if these broads don't shut up, the top of my head's going to blow off. I'm going to go insane. So we get back to the office, and I grabbed Suzanne, and I took her outside the office, and I was on Sunset Boulevard and Hollywood Boulevard in front of All American Burger, and I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I have 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. She dropped everything. She canceled all her appointments. She took me to her place. She sat me down at her dining room table, and she 12-stepped me. She read Chapter 5, Chapter 3, The 12 Traditions. I thought, that woman's going to read that entire book to me. She gave me, and I can taste it to this day, orange juice and Karo syrup, just to kind of calm the jitters a little. And she told me her story. Now, my story was disgusting, but hers was unbelievable. Oh my God, this woman can stay sober. I got a chance. I mean, whoa. And she took me to my first meeting, and it was exactly what she said, do you believe in God? And I said, I suppose so. She said, that's good enough. And I explained to her, I said, now listen, I understand this drinking thing is killing me. And I said, but I mean, the withdrawal, I can't afford to go to a hospital. I have no money. I have a lot of nice sports jackets, but I have no money. And what I think I should do is I think I should stop drinking this instant, but what I think I'll do is continue to take Valium so that I can kind of touch down lightly into this sobriety. You know, kind of, you know, because the withdrawal, and she said, listen, honey, we consider sobriety in Southern California as clean and sober. Now, this was 23 years ago, and I got to tell, I said, well, what does that mean? She said, that means we don't drink, and we don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals that affect us from the neck up. I was real disappointed at that news. So I said, how am I going to do this? She said, you're going to shake it up. So she took me to my first meeting. It was in Las Feliz. It was on a Wednesday night. There were 400 people there. It was in a church basement. It had gray walls, low ceiling, filled with smoke, and all the people that I never would have drank with were there. And it must have been a real slow night for newcomers because they were all over. It was like being dropped into a shark tank. I've never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. And now, I don't know how they knew that. I don't know how they knew. I mean, because I want to tell you, I went dressed. I looked like this. I mean, I went in my shirt and my tie. I had on a $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue. I had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I had several national commercials running on television as the nice young man next door. They'd only known what was going on next door. I looked fabulous at my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I walked in, and everybody knew. There were a couple of things that were going on that I wasn't aware of. One, that I'd been drinking straight vodka the night before, and it was a rather warm April night, and I had on a lot of lemon-lime cologne, and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing that was going on was that I had newcomer eyes. Now, the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I'm absolutely terrified. And looking cool, And you were all over me. Oh, God, you touched it. Oh, got into my space, and my face. I mean, you were... up close, then he does it. What about? Oh man, it was just awful. And then the meeting started, and I sat down, and I sat between two guys. One of them was this little guy named Jimmy, and Jimmy is a little black guy who's around Alcoholics Anonymous to this day. I just saw him this year. And Jimmy has problems other than alcoholism, and Jimmy talks to the speakers. And so whenever the speaker says anything that Jimmy likes, Jimmy says, yeah. And then when they come to sing in the birthdays, he sings loud, and Jimmy can't carry a tune in the bucket. So they're singing happy, and Jimmy's going, happy birthday to... And I'm thinking, this is my life. This is it. This is what it's going to be like, And then there's this little guy sitting next to me. Now, this little guy started telling me a story, and it was absolutely amazing. It was an AA miracle. A miracle. This guy started telling me a story. His story was exactly the same as mine. It was unbelievable. Now, Suzanne, when she was 12-stepping me, kept jumping up and running out of the room, and I thought she was one of those ones with kidney damage. She'd probably gone a little too far. What I found out about a year and a half later was, as I was telling her my story, she was going into the bedroom and phoning Jack and telling him my story. So the guy who was sitting next to me was Jack. No wonder his story was exactly the same as mine. He knew what mine was. See, the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous lie to you like rubs. And the way they get away with it is they say, more will be revealed. So he became my sponsor, and he started teaching me the 12 steps. He taught me everything I believe in. And we didn't go to step studies or anything like that. They just shoved this thing down my throat. I mean, they just, oh man, it was just merciless. Just ripped into me with these 12 steps and said, do them. And he talked to his sponsor, and they decided they had to get me to do a fifth step real fast, because if any kind of crisis happened, I'd go. And so they did that. When I was 3 weeks sober, the little son of a bitch turned on me and told me I had 3 weeks to do my fourth step. Now, I didn't know you couldn't do your fourth step when you're 3 weeks sober, so I did it. And when I was 6 weeks sober, I read it to him, and he told me his story more in depth, and suddenly there was something going on. There was somebody who was like me, who knew me. And, all my life I've been looking for somebody to just know me. I just wanted somebody in my life to just know who the hell I was, because I'd been an outlaw and an alien and an unwelcome guest all my life. I just wanted to let somebody see it all. Just let me know who I was, because I knew it was too much of a risk before I got here. It was just too much of a risk because I was such a failure. It didn't matter what I was. I was 15 years sober, and I was talking to somebody about what I'd done in New York. I went to New York with no training, no nothing. I went to New York with $50 in my pocket, and I auditioned for Broadway shows. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people come to New York every year to do this. And I got one. And there was this ad in a paper one time. They were replacing a part in a hit Broadway musical, and they needed a guy who was around 25 years old, 6 feet, blonde brown hair, baritone tenor, can sing, dance, or act. And I went. You know, I got my little picture, and I went down to the Winter Garden Theater, and there were 150 guys that looked exactly like me, and we auditioned for 8 hours. We sang, and then we danced, and then we read, and then they cut us down, and they, you know, I did that for 8 hours. And at the end of the 8 hours, the director, who was a very famous Broadway director, said, "You got the job, Sean." And I said, "Thank you very much." And as I walked out, I thought the guy must have been in stock who was supposed to be getting this job. So whatever victory I ever had in my life, I snatched it out of, I ripped it apart myself. You know, I never allowed myself to have anything that I'd ever done, any kind of accomplishment. I was always looking at the dark side. I was always looking at the failure while I was trying to be okay. I was always building a house while I was destroying the foundation. And the fifth step enabled me to have somebody to look at me and know me absolutely and say, "Hey, you know, it's going to be okay. You got all the stuff you need." See, what is important in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's important for you to know if you're new. You know, the professionals, Tom and Terry, will talk to you about the soul. And they, you know, those guys and the nuns and that kind of stuff would try to teach me that, but I couldn't hear it from them. But what I can tell you if you knew is that there's some part of you that is absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. And what we will do is we will shovel away all the stuff that's covering that up for you to find it. And when you find it, then you get to share it. And that's the miracle. That's why we stay sober here. So he got me active the first night that I was sober. He told me to pick up my coffee cup and wash it and fold up the chair that I was sitting in. And I've been doing that kind of stuff on various levels since. Now, I had this relationship that was problematic at best by the time we arrived, and I sincerely talked to my sponsor, and I said, "Listen, by this time, a couple of weeks had gone by, and Bonnie had gotten into Al-Anon, and she seemed to have found something there." And I said to Jack, "Listen, there's been far too much damage here. It can't be repaired. We've done too much to each other, and I think the most loving thing that I can do is to divorce her." And he said, "You're not going to make any emotional decisions in your first year of sobriety." And I said, "What the hell does that mean?" And he said, "That means you're not going to divorce your wife. You're not going to fall in love with anybody else. You're not going to move. You're not going to redecorate. You're not going to buy new furniture. You're not going to get a new car. You're not going to change jobs. You're not going to go on a diet and lose 35 pounds. You're not going to quit smoking. You're not going to start going to a gym. You're not going to start jogging. You're not going to run for 26 months. You're not going to do a goddamn thing. You're going to put your entire life on hold, and you're going to work the steps, and you get sober, and it takes about a year." And I said, "But you don't understand. I'm not sure that I love her." And he said, "I don't give a damn about love. Work on good manners." So I started saying please and thank you to this stranger that I was living with. And we went through the first year of sobriety. And let me tell you, the first year of sobriety, I was one of the last of the batch that they gave a half a cup of coffee to, because I was a little jumpy when I arrived. I was coming off of everything. I was just, woo! And I was always went to Sports Shack. When I was about 4 days sober, somebody who didn't know me asked me to read chapter 5, and I read it and sat down, and she said it was the first time she'd ever heard it read in one breath. I was a little zippy when I arrived here. So we started on this thing. Now, I want to tell you, you know, if you hear somebody from the podium say, "You know, I used to drink like a pig, and then I got sober, my life is a dream now," what they're telling you is a fairy tale. And what this thing is not a fairy tale. This is an adventure. And this is the wildest, most incredible adventure you'll ever be on in your entire life. And like any adventure, in order for it to be a great story, it's got to have real good stuff and really lousy stuff. And that comes and goes in this life. And sometimes it comes in combinations. And that's the thing that kills me. Because I either want it to be all great or all lousy. I can handle one or the other. But a combination of stuff is really difficult. And that's life on life's terms. And slowly but surely, they started to wrench me out of this nightmare and this fantasy world that I was living in into some kind of reality. And he started teaching me absolutely basic stuff about ethics and morals and dignity and usefulness and all the stuff that we get taught here by dumb things. One of the things that they made me do, because I wore a sports jacket, was stand on Sunday night at Wilshire Normandy and shake hands. Clint was talking about, I hated shaking hands. I'd have rather eaten ground glass than shake hands. But my sponsor did it, and I was scared of him, so he told me to do it. Now, I didn't know what the hell it was, because, see, they don't tell you what you're doing, because if they told you, you go, oh, please, you know, I'm not doing, oh, man. And I'll tell you what it is. This is what it is. I'm a shy person. What I've done to overcompensate for it appalls me, but I'm a shy person. I would like it to be kind of like a psychological disorder. I'd like it to be something beyond what I can do. You know, I'd like to have another 12-step program. I don't think 480 is enough. You know, I think we ought to have a 12-step program for guys like me. SA, Shy Anonymous. You know, they'd be real quiet meetings because people would be too shy to share, and it'd be real small, people would be too shy to come, you know, but one of the things that I absolutely hate is walking into rooms full of people I don't know. I used to have 4 belts before I could go to a small dinner party, you know, just to be calm enough, just to be cool enough to get in the door. I hate it. And walking into a room this size, I mean, I just go, and they go, I get to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, because there's a lot of speaker meetings in Southern California, I would drive to them, and a lot of people knew my car, you know, and I would drive into the parking lot, and I'd sit in my car, and people would say, isn't that wonderful? Sean's getting his spiritual message together. And what I was doing was I was sitting in the car saying, you got to get out of the car, Sean. They've seen you. You can't drive out. And so what I do is I get out of the car, and I go, and I walk toward the door, and some poor jerk whose sponsors made him do it is standing at the door, and what he does is he sticks out his hand, and he says, hi, I'm Fred. And he takes my hand, and he pulls me into the room. And that's an act of love. And I didn't know that when they made me do it. I found out later. And there's all kinds of stuff. Washing cups is an act of love. Buying literature is an act of love. Mopping floors is an act of love. Being the secretary is an act of love. Sponsoring somebody, being a GSR, being an intergroup rep. Those are acts of love, and that's what turns us into loving people. Because when I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, because of my illness, I've got an 85-year-old mother who's kind of chronically ill, but there's nothing really wrong with her. She's just old and ill, and it's all kind of closing down on her, you know? And her whole life is about her. It's all I, me, how she feels, you know, how her bowels are working, you know, man, and she drives me nuts, and I feel guilty about it, you know? I just feel guilty about it until I finally realize what it is. She hooks into that, my alcoholism, you know? Because when you're so ill from alcoholism, when you're just trying to make it happen so that you can survive enough to get through another goddamn day, you know? Just keep it working a little longer. It's all about me. How am I going to recover from this? My God, I've got to earn enough money to pay the rent so I can get enough booze and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's all... So when we arrive, it's all about me. And what the sponsors do is they start shoving me out of me. Pick up that chair. Shake that hand. Read chapter 5. They keep pushing me out of me. Pushing me into being somehow of service. Because when I'm of service, I suddenly start to get a little more concerned with you than I am with me. See, the problem with alcoholism is introspection kills us. Me going inward kills me. The only way I've ever found any solution in my life is going outward. Is going out to you. How you doing? How you doing? What's happening with you? And you tell me what's happening with you. And as you tell me, I see the reflection. I see what's happening with me. The reason we tell each other our stories is so that we can see that it's happening there. And if it's happening there, then it may be happening here. And so that's one of the reasons I keep coming back. I got to I got to be a year sober, and I got a job that took me out of town. And out of town, I went to a lot of meetings, and I was all over North America. And by the time I came back, an amazing thing had happened with Bonnie and I. Because, see, this thing isn't about relationships. That happens accidentally. What had happened was I came back to town, and I didn't need her. And she'd been in Al-Anon a year, and she didn't need me. Our worst fear, you know? Our worst fear, we didn't need each other. But we wanted to be together because I'd never met anybody. I just never met anybody like her. And so we started building a relationship on a very different level. Now, I would like you to know that I got my alcoholism kind of whipped into shape and just really spiffy. By the time I was 5 years sober, I was very, very sober. I mean, I was Captain Sobriety, as a matter of fact. I mean, I was meeting meetings, I was talking from podiums, I had sponsored a half a dozen guys, I was driving all over the place. I mean, it was just incredible. But what had happened was that I hit this thing that so many of us hit between 5 and 7 years. There's a wall that we hit. And it's about the second surrender is what it is. You know, everything was working. The only trouble was that I was 5 years sober, and I was so sober that I decided to try and test the fence lines of my sobriety. I just wanted to see if I could be sober this far out from the center. And I started looking at some really old ideas. And when I was 5 and a half years sober, I blew my life and my marriage apart. I just ripped myself to shreds. Bonnie was at her Al-Anon meeting, and she came home from her Al-Anon meeting, and she walked in the kitchen and said, "Oh my God, what's happened?" And I told her what had happened. I'd gotten busted, and the same thing had happened to me sober, you know, fingerprinted and photographed and all that wonderful stuff. And the miracle of Al-Anon had happened for her because she didn't start screaming. She didn't start saying, "What are you doing to my life? What are you doing to our marriage?" She didn't do any of that stuff. What she said was, well, she looked at me for a long, long time, and then she reached across the table and she put her hand on the side of my face and she said, "Oh, Sean, I'm so sorry you have to hurt yourself so bad." And we started talking to our sponsors, and I did some writing about where I was at and what I was going on and what I was doing, and she did too, and we decided that we wanted to continue with this relationship, and she made couple of requirements that she required fidelity and loyalty, and if I could supply that, she would stay married because she loved me. But if I couldn't, she was going to leave because she loved me. And I made a decision, and we continued with this thing. When I was about 8 years sober, we had been playing a little Vatican roulette, and Bonnie got pregnant, and my daughter Kate was born. Now, you have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. This creature came into my life, this extraordinary creature. One of the things as an alcoholic, see, I think that somehow I've been dealt just a certain amount of love, and that it gets used up or something. I mean, I don't know what I got all these weird ideas from somewhere that I have this finite amount, you know, and I got to be very careful with it. And what happens is love expands. I mean, it just expands. And, you know, you love the guys you sponsor. You love, you just learn to love around here. And a part of me that I was fine living without just opened up in me. And Kate's here with us. She's an extraordinary young lady. We've had quite a journey. It's been really, really incredible. About 10 years ago, a guy that I was sponsoring, we started talking about writing, and he came from the same area of the country that I came from, and we started writing, and we put together some projects, and there was some nice response to it, and I had an opportunity to go to Vancouver, to go back to my home country for business purposes. It was an incredible career opportunity, and at that point, some kind of negative stuff had happened. I mean, the birth of my child had happened, and the joy of Kate coming into my life had happened at about the same time when that man who had taught me everything that I know and that I love more than I loved anybody, really, had borrowed an enormous amount of money from me, a lot of money, and didn't pay it back. my sponsor, and I came to find out that that man didn't have a seventh tradition in his own life. I mean, the man who had taught me to put $5 bills in letters to companies that I owed money to was not about to pay me back for the money, and we were in a terrible financial state, a terrible, terrible financial state, and we were about to lose our house, and I had just I didn't have a job. I had gotten out of a job, and I was looking for a job, and the loans that were covering this money that I'd lent to my sponsor were coming due, and I mean, it was a nightmare. And we had a brand new baby, and no money. I got a job, and we went to the bank to try to refinance the house, and the bank said, "You haven't been at that job long enough, and we can't do it." And oh God, we were. And praying and working hard and trying to make it happen. And Bonnie said, after a little while, she said, "Why don't we go back to the bank and see, maybe there's something we can do." And we walked into the bank, and they said, "Oh, we have a new manager." And we walked over, and there was this enormous fat woman. She was the biggest woman I've ever seen with these glasses, and her name was Eloise. And she was terrific. And we said, "This is what we're doing, Eloise, and this is what we're trying to do." And she said, "No problem." And she processed the whole thing, and we saved the house. And about 3 weeks later, Bonnie went into the bank to do some things, and she said, she wanted to say thank you to Eloise. And they said, "Oh, Eloise was only here for a short time. She's been transferred to another branch." And so we've always laughed that God had to get dressed up and drag and call himself Eloise. To get us out. But this opportunity came to move to Vancouver, and the three of us went up to Vancouver and checked it out, and we had a family conference because we do the traditions at our house, and unity is one of the things, and everyone is autonomous, and we all have opinions, and we scoped out the place, and we all said, "What do you want to do?" And we said, "Let's do it." I was saying that, you just never know what the seminal thing is. I was looking in the LA Times one day, and there was a guy who was sentenced after sexually assaulting Minnie Mouse at Disneyland, and I said, "That's it, we're out of here. I mean, that's enough. I've had it. That's it. We're out of California." So we went up to we went up to Vancouver, and the thing went incredibly well. I mean, I wrote and produced this motion picture, and when it opened, it was just it was just the most incredible thing that I'd ever done. You know, it was just fabulous, and there I was at the pinnacle of my life. You know, and they diagnosed me with skin cancer. The old yin and the yang, you know, and I went, "Man, this is unbelievable." So they started taking bits and pieces of me away. You know, anything that looks funny on me, they cut off. I've had to give up my night job with Strippogram, but I. I left that company and under weird circumstances, and I started down a road of trying to be okay with this working thing. I've gotten into projects that haven't worked out, and the last thing that I did was a couple of years ago. I got into business with another guy in the program, we put together a community newspaper, and a community newspaper takes a long time to become successful, and I was financing it. And what was happening is I got into something that was almost like, it was like addictive behavior. I was writing checks to save it. You know, one more check, and then it'll turn around, and then it wouldn't turn around, and I'd write another check. And Bonnie at that point had some back and neck problems, and she had gotten over that, and she had gotten a job, and she had a very high stress job, and I decided that I was going to fix it. What I was going to do was I was going to fix the situation, and then I was going to tell her about all the problems. I don't know whether it was a macho thing or whether it was alcoholic. I don't know what it was, but I was trying to be a good guy, and I was trying desperately not to fail. And what happened is this business kind of tipped over slowly like some ocean liner and sank slowly beneath, just hideously. And what I did was I wrote away our future, and I wrote away. And when I finally... had to tell Bonnie the exact nature of my wrong, the exact nature of our financial situation. All her years in Al-Anon have gotten her in touch with her feelings, let me tell you. She did not rise above it with serenity and grace. She tore a strip off my ass and poured gasoline on it. I mean, she was mad. She was mad because I didn't trust her enough. She was mad because I was protecting her, that I was treating her like a little girl, that I was doing a lot of dumb stuff, and that I'd put us in financial danger, real financial danger. And we had to make some rapid decisions. We had to make some real moves. And one of the things we had to do was we had a big, beautiful house that overlooked the ocean, and that go. And what we could afford in order to get us out of this thing was a condominium. And we looked around for a condominium, and we lived in 2,700 square feet in this big house. And then we went to look at condominiums that were 1,100 square feet, and we found one that looked like it would work. And I brought them to see it, and we walked in, and I could see Bonnie kind of heart sink as we looked at this small space, small for us. But you know, kids that are raised in sobriety are sometimes pretty extraordinary. We looked around this place, and Kate went down the hall, looked around, and she came back, and she said, "This is the amount of space we live in now. We live in the den, we live in our two bedrooms, we don't go in the living room or the dining room. This is what we live in now. What's the big deal?" And we kind of went, okay, you know. So we bought the thing and you know, made an offer contingent on our house selling, and the house sold it one day, and bam, we were there. And we've had a real rough transition. We've had a really terrible time, and I'm 55 years old, so I'm looking for a job, you know, and I'm, you know, I sent out 50 resumes, and I got 50 thank you and screw you letters back, you know. You know, when I got a letter back, I mean, they're retiring guys like me, they're not hiring guys like me, and I mean, I was out there, and I mean, it's all hitting me. I mean, you know, I'm over the hill, I'm a failure, I've used up all my money. I mean, it's a disaster as far as I'm concerned, you know. And I mean, how in God's name can I get up at a podium and tell you everything's swell? Because it's a lie. And one of the things you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous is if I'm going to be at this podium, it's the respect of this podium to tell you the absolute truth of where I'm at and what I'm coming from. And man, I was out there, and it wasn't working. And she's working her ass off. She's coming home at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night from this store, beat. And every time she does, something inside me dies, you know? And what I'm doing is I'm making beds and I'm vacuuming. I'm doing the grocery shopping. I mean, I got to do my part, and it's eating me alive because I'm not good at any of that stuff. I mean, you should taste some of my meals, you know. And I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm just out there trying to do whatever I can. And then my sponsor says at the job, they're looking for somebody. Put in a resume. I said, "Oh, Milton, not that one. Not that one." And he said, "You done the third step?" "Yeah." And he said, "You turned your will over to God?" "Yeah." And he said, "Are you doing full work?" "Yeah." "Well, then do this." So they interviewed me, and I got it. I'm the manager of the Intergroup in Vancouver. If Cirque du Soleil put on a production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that's what it would be like. I mean, it is just nuts. It is just... And I walked in and they hate me. Because the assistant manager, who's this fabulous woman who applied for the job, they took me instead of her. She's working through it in her office. And everybody's, oh man, it's been unbelievable. But you know what? I go to work every day. I work at from 7 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I go over the bridge at 6:30 in the morning and say, "Thank you, God, for letting me drive over the bridge to go to a job," you know. And when I come home every day, I feel like I've done something. I mean, I've done a lot of flashy stuff in my time. I've done a lot of stuff that didn't amount to a hill of beans as far as anybody's lives go, you know. I've acted and performed and been adorable and written a lot of stupid stuff.
you know. But on a daily basis, people's lives get saved and changed to that office that I'm running, and I love it. I absolutely love it. What a sense of having a life that means something and does something. And we're not out of the woods yet. I mean, we're still dealing with the wreckage of this stuff. I mean, there's, you know, the credit cards are getting paid off a bit at a time and you know, all that stuff. And I don't know how it's working out. And we got real far apart. We got real far apart. As far apart as we were in our first year of this journey. You know, when a couple comes to Alcoholics Anonymous and one goes to Al-Anon, they separate. They may live under the same roof, but they separate because they got it to find out who they are. And this last year, we felt like that because she was angry and hurt at what I did, and I was terrified and felt like a fool, you know. And those old feelings came back to me. Father Terry's here, and Terry was one of the guys who first identified my entire motivation. You know, he said he drank because he didn't want to feel embarrassed. And, you know, that's why I drank. Because I felt embarrassed. I wish I'd had towering emotions, you know. I wish I was one of those guys in AA that, you know, stole a tugboat or came to in Kuala Lumpur or went to death row like a regular guy in AA, you know. But I just did a series of foolish, embarrassing, slimy, smarmy, tacky, stupid things over and over and over again, interspersed with occasional spectacular achievements, you know. And I was feeling like that again. I was feeling like an old fool, you know. And the reason I felt like that was I'd done some foolish things. And so what we're doing is we're working on putting this thing together again. Our marriage is not in trouble, but there's trouble in our marriage, and we're working through it, and we're talking, and it's gingerly doing it because we're a little wounded. The wonderful thing about being here is Bonnie gets to talk to some extraordinary women in Al-Anon who have changed her life, and I get to be next to some men that have done it for me. It would be very difficult to communicate to you what it means to be in the same room with Paul and Cliff and Milton and Bob and Terry and Tom. I mean, it's just... My heroes used to be cowboys. And now my heroes are gentlemen in Alcoholics Anonymous. The rooms here are filled with the resources that people like you and I need to live and to grow and to change and to become useful and to have some dignity and be loving human beings. And the opportunity to be here is stunning to me. I'm standing before my elders tonight, and the only people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only people who ever taught me anything were the people here. Before I got here, I went to moral authorities. I was always going to doctors and priests and psychiatrists and psychologists and gurus and inspirational guys and doctors and lawyers and policemen and I was explaining to them my problem, and some of them had learning, and some of them really cared about us, and they had diplomas, and they said, this is what you should do about your life. And when people point a finger at me and say, this is what you should do about your life, I bite it off at the knuckle, because I can't hear it. I can't hear it. I don't know why. Alcoholism did some kind of permanent damage to me, and I can't hear it. But I came here, and you said, this is what I've done about my life. Take what you can use, and it's your experience. And I can't say, wait a minute, that's not your experience, because it's your experience. And it may be more true for you than it is for me, but it is the truth, and I have to listen to it. And because of that, You're my teachers. And whenever I'm in trouble, and I've been in trouble this last little while, I haven't thought about drinking, but I sure have thought about walking into the Burrard Inlet in a suit, you know? I was at a conference one time, and I was flying home, and we went through some real turbulence, and I said, okay, God, I mean, this would probably be a good way, you know? I'm overinsured. This would probably solve all the financial problems, you know? And then I looked at the guy next to me, and I thought, well, it may not be a great solution for him, you know? Well, the other 350 people on this plane, so all right, I mean, I guess I'll show up tomorrow, you know? And I'm a little self-centered. So I come to you. I come back to you all the time because you're my teachers. And so I stand before you tonight to tell you I'm dancing as fast as I can. You know, it's getting better. This thing works. It works in good times and bad times, and let you know that this is one of the parts of my adventure that I'm sure will be really amusing sometime later. But I'm standing before you, my teachers, to let you know who I am. Because I owe you that. I owe you that because you've told me who you are over the years. I've watched you walk through these kind of things, and you've been honest enough to tell me exactly how it feels. And exactly what you did to get out of it. And it's my responsibility to do that. So if you're sitting there judging me, judge me lightly. I'm a work in progress. And I'm trying real hard to be okay. And I love you very, very much. God bless you.
I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Today, after a moment, or no, Roy's going to read the vision for you. Roy?
Hi, my name's Roy, and I'll always be an alcoholic.
A vision for you from our text. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right. And great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.